This is the Talking Pictures podcast presented by the Film and Photography Society at UCLA. Today we'll be talking about adaptation and why it may be the greatest screenplay ever written. But first, a brief introduction of our hosts and their favorite book-to-movie adaptation.
Hi, I'm Eli. I am the Internal Affairs Director of FPS, and my favorite book-to-movie adaptation is The Shawshank Redemption.
Nice pick, nice pick. What's up, guys? I'm Andrew Jumle. I am the Media Director for FPS this year, and my favorite book-to-movie adaptation is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Although I haven't read One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, so that's kind of dumb, but...
It's okay, yeah. I haven't read the short story for Shawshank Redemption either.
Okay, we're chilling. Okay, adaptation, directed by Spike Jonze, released in... What year was it, Eli? Do you remember?
2002.
Oh, okay. The year that we were both born, so...
Yep.
Okay, cool. Eli, you recommended it. What'd you think of it?
So, I love this movie. I think it's the best script ever written. It's not even my favorite Charlie Kaufman movie. My favorite movie ever is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. But I think, you know, there's a lot of things that go into a movie. There's the screenplay, there's actual direction, there's the score. And just on a screenplay script level, adaptation is just the most brilliant thing that anybody has ever written, ever. You watched it for the first time, right?
Yes. So my original, before I went into the movie, I knew that it was going to be a bit of a thonker. Like, I've heard plenty of great stuff about it. A lot of the reviews discuss how it was like, oh, a lot of things are going on inside my head right now after people watch it. You know, it's like a lot to think about, a lot to process. So I was ready for that. I had my notes on everything and I was writing. And surprisingly enough, it was definitely a very deep film with a lot of like symbolism, a lot of metaphors, motifs. But I think that the movie was actually very digestible and also quite enjoyable, even if it was quite a complex film.
Yeah, I think it's a movie that like doesn't take a ton of thought to really enjoy, but the more you think about it, the more that it like just works.
Yeah.
So I guess for any listeners who like don't know anything about this movie, I can give a bunch of context. So... Susan Orlean, at some point in the late 90s, early 2000s, she's a writer for The New Yorker, and she wrote this book called The Orchid Thief, about, like, flowers and this dude named John LaRoche. And basically before the book even came out, they were trying to option it into a movie. Charlie Kaufman ended up being the one who was supposed to write it. He was just coming off of being John Malkovich. And he had so much trouble figuring out how to adapt this book that he ended up making a script about his struggle adapting the book. And then that's what the final movie ends up being, is it's about him trying to write the script that he's writing in the movie. And he actually, I don't know if you know this, Andrew, mm-hmm. he turned this in without any warning to the studio executives.
I did not know that. That's crazy.
Like, they thought he was writing a straightforward adaptation, like, of The Orchid Thief. And he just sort of came back, like, way past deadline and was like, here it is. This is not at all what you expect. Enjoy. And I think him and, like, Spike Jonze were the only ones who, like, knew what was going on.
What the fuck? Wow. And then, yeah. And the studio... I'm assuming the studio, like... placed a lot of opposition on the script at first, right? Like, surely.
I actually don't know if they did. I in my reading, have not found anything about that. But I know that the biggest roadblock was actually Susan Orlean herself. Because we'll go into, like, the third act and stuff like that later. But the depiction of her in this movie, I don't know if I would have signed on to it if I was her. But apparently what they told her was, hey... we're not pressuring you into anything, but everybody else has signed off on this. All that has to happen is if you say yes, this movie's getting made. And so she sort of like reluctantly said yes. And I think as years went on, she's like really come to appreciate. I mean, look, if I was played by Meryl Streep, I wouldn't really care what they did about me. So, yeah. So I think like the fact that anybody agreed to this movie being made is kind of a miracle. And then there's also just some, like, weird, you know, like, you know, Tom Hanks was originally supposed to play Charlie Kaufman. But I think Nicolas Cage is, like, perfect.
Yeah, he was way better.
Maybe it's just because I think he knows exactly how much, like, I think with every Nicolas Cage performance, there's, like, a level of, like, irony to it.
Yeah.
Or just a level of, like, you know, like, camp to it. And, I, you know, when you're playing the writer of the film that you're in and also his fictional twin brother, like, that's kind of what you need to bring to it. I think Nicolas Cage was just sort of perfect for this.
I fully agree that Nicolas Cage was the better choice, like, vastly superior choice. Like you said, his performances usually have a bit of irony in them. And he's just a better comedic actor, I'd say. And this movie is hilarious. It's so fucking funny. Okay, funny enough, when I saw that the movie was written by Charlie Kaufman and Donald Kaufman, I was like, shit, so Charlie has a brother. I look it up. That shit's fake. The credits are right, fictionalized.
His brother is fake, but is in real life nominated for an Oscar.
What? Really?
His name was really on the script.
Yeah.
And this movie got nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. So
Donald Kaufman, a man who doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. He has an Oscar nomination.
Wow. Okay. And we'll get into why he decides to create this twin brother figure too. Like it's pretty cool. And yeah, I just love that. And also, besides Nicolas Cage, you talked about how Susan Orlean had a hard time like approving of the script. I am now really curious as to, like, how much of this film is actually based off of reality and how much of it is based off of, like, Charlie Kaufman's wild imaginations, which we'll save for, like, later discussion. But it really is a miracle that Susan Orlean agreed to it. I can't believe that she said yes, because I feel like most people, the smart decision would be to say no, you know? And looking back, it was the smarter decision to say yes just because the movie was made, but, like, I mean, and we'll discuss why, but yeah. So I just want to say that anyone that's going to watch this movie, which you absolutely should watch it, like at least once in your life, go in, like expecting nothing, knowing nothing, and just like have an open mind. Because I feel like if you have like a closed mind, then I can see someone like finding this movie extremely tacky and very like off-putting and a bit too surreal for their taste. But that's like the whole point. 'Cause what the movie is truly about is... Well, you know what? No, we got to start the spoiler territory now.
Yeah. So before we like actually start going into that, I just want to say like, go watch this movie if you haven't. Like, pause this podcast, go watch it, and come back because like it's really something that I think is best to experience completely blind. Just go watch it. Both of us love this movie.
Highly recommend. I gave it 4.5 stars. 4.5 stars on Letterboxd. Booyah! Okay. 9 out of 10. Yeah.
Okay. So hopefully you're back now. If you went and just watched the movie. Now we're going to start talking about spoilers. Why I think this is the best script ever written is it's sort of like an onion in that it's like, or like a Russian nesting doll in that there are like three different layers of story going on at once. Right?
Yeah.
On one level, it is like a genuine adaptation of The Orchid Thief. We'll like talk about that in a little bit.
Yeah.
And on another level, it's a fictionalized retelling of Charlie Kaufman's struggles to adapt The Orchid Thief. And then on a third level, it is sort of a meta-textual criticism of Hollywood screenwriting. And then there's kind of like a fourth level that's just sort of like its own thing. Like the movie itself.
I wanted to add the fourth level is about Charlie Kaufman and about how all of us try to find our place in first of all, in society and in the world and in the universe too. Because this movie, like, it really broadens its themes to not just, like, a screenwriter, but, like, a person living on Earth or a person living in the universe. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I'll get into that more too.
So yeah, I think like going into the first level, right? Like in talking about like how hard it is to adapt this book, it sort of also is telling the audience like what is in the book and what makes the book so great. Like you sort of get these snippets with Meryl Streep and Chris Cooper that basically retell the events of the book. But, you know, do it in a way that, like, the audience is, might as well be sort of reading the book and understanding what's in it. And then as Charlie's sort of talking about, like, okay, how do I start this? How do I convey the ideas in this book? You pick up more and more, like, why this book is actually good without it actually being able to fully be adapted to the screen.
Yeah. No, I wanted to add, well, first of all, I wanted to ask Eli if you know, like, what exactly happens in The Orchid Thief? Can we provide, like, a
quick I have
synopsis?
No idea.
Oh, okay.
I only know what's in the movie.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to assume that everything in the movie up until the third act is exactly what's in the book.
I'm going to assume the same thing. And if that's the case, well, then The Orchid Thief is about, well, this writer named Susan Orlean follows this horticulturist named John LaRoche, who is deeply enamored with and deeply interested in finding this very extremely rare flower called the ghost orchid. Yeah, it's this highly coveted flower, and he believes that he has the knowledge and the abilities and the skills to cultivate it and resell it on larger markets. And that's the story, so.
Right. And sort of what, like, I think adaptation really tries to sell is, like, what makes the book work is that it's just about somebody who really cares about something, who's really passionate about, you know, in this case, flowers, and has something that they're, you know, really invested in. They have something that they're chasing, and it, you know, becomes about passion. And also, you know, there's some themes in there about, like, disappointment, right? Susan Orlean never does find a ghost orchid, and so the book is sort of left open-ended in that way. You know, it's about sort of the wonders of nature and the balance of, like, you know, there's sort of a layer of, like, adaptation is also literally about adaptation of living beings in nature.
Yeah.
Right? There's a whole monologue about how, you know, every flower has an insect or a bird that goes along with it. Like, in failing to adapt all of it and explaining how he failed to adapt all of it, he kind of shows, like, what was in the book to begin with and why it was so hard to adapt and why the ideas in there were, like, so easy to, you know, mess up and hard to translate to the screen.
Yeah.
Though somehow in doing that, he does translate it to the screen. It's like kind of crazy the way that it all comes together. If you have anything else to say sort of about
the first layer. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that layer.
I wanted to talk about how, to me, the film, its point in trying to adapt The Orchid Thief and executing it the way it does is to show the power of film and storytelling. So, I mean, you guys heard the synopsis of The Orchid Thief. Is it the book you'd really be interested in reading? I don't think so. And even Charlie Kaufman fully acknowledges in the movie, just how boring and how dull of a book it is. Like, it's beautiful, sure, it has, like, its musings, but it lacks a strong ending. It's something that not many people would really find appealing, like, who gives a shit about flowers? I think that's, like, literally said in one point in the movie. Like, who gives a fuck about flowers, right? But then the thing is, Kaufman decides to take the ending of a book, or to use the content, the subject matter of the book, and sort of construct his own ending that works best for his own story and his own voice. To do that in his film is just so, to me, like, such a revolutionary way of storytelling that I'm sure it has existed, like, well before he's even, like, written these scripts, but it's just it's a very transformative thing to watch, you know, to realize, wait a second, I can literally do whatever I want, and it can be good, because that's what adaptation's showing.
Right. Well, and I think the ending that we end up with comes from the, like, upper levels of the Onion, if we want to call it that.
Yeah.
You know, that it comes from, like, you know, in being a Hollywood movie, you need a Hollywood story structure and a Hollywood ending, and the book just doesn't have that. So
yeah.
So the movie sort of, like, with a wink and a nod, makes one up.
Yes.
And I think that's so fun. But yeah, so on to the second layer, right? The fictionalized retelling of Kaufman's struggles to adapt The Orchid Thief. I think this is, like, this could be really tough to pull off, honestly, right? Like, you're writing a script about itself.
Yes.
And I think doing something like that can be really easy to come off as, you know, pretentious or, like, overindulgent or, like, you know, self-interested.
Narcissistic.
But I think, like, Matrix Resurrections is a good example of that, where it's very much commenting on itself, but it, like, becomes too on the nose and stuff like that. But I think the way that adaptation manages to do that without making it seem, pretentious or narcissistic is that it just sort of paints Charlie Kaufman as a terrible person. He's just like this really like awkward, like lonely,
A loser.
like he's a lo like
To
he's he,
be blunt.
downright like depraved at some points. He is
Yes.
like kind of a menace to society.
He's one bad day
And
from being
just
an
like,
incel. One bad day from being an incel,
no,
yeah.
incel 100%.
Yeah.
So I think like, he's telling it of himself, but he's also like kind of destroying his own image in the process. And I think that's just like such a smart way of doing it and like humbling yourself as you're making it.
Yeah, it's the what makes the second layer work is the honesty and vulnerability. Whereas most other people would write about themselves and try to glorify their struggles and their suffering as like, oh, it's poetic, it's meant to be, it's so that I can win in the end. With Charlie Kaufman, it's like he really degrades himself in the movie, and at many points you get like a lot of voiceovers of him just like insulting, like flat out insulting himself, like I'm a fucking loser. I'm so fucking worthless. I can't even talk to her. I can't even, yeah, just like a lot of things that. And honestly, a lot of things that I can imagine others would like think in their heads in re in reality, and so that's what makes it sort of that's what gives it its relatability as well.
And then let's talk about, because you had things you wanted to say about the invention of Charlie Kaufman's twin brother, Donald, also played by
Yes.
Nicolas Cage in like a Army Hammer, Social Network, body doubling kind
Yeah.
of effect. Though I guess this came first, so.
Yeah. So, okay, so this kind of links to the third layer, but we'll hold off on that. I just thought the well, the creation of the twin brother is supposed to represent another side of Charlie Kaufman. Another side. A side, it's the twin brothers are constantly conflicting and constantly fighting, and it's supposed to represent, as kind of obvious as it is, an internal conflict within Kaufman himself as to how he wants to approach writing and art and his passions and just life in general.
I definitely think so. Charlie is the like really like pretentious, creative, like, you have to reinvent the wheel every time you write a script. You have to like be incredibly, outside the box and intellectual about everything.
Yes.
Whereas Donald is sort of this like dumb, easygoing, like just
Formulaic.
do it,
Yeah.
stick by the like stick to the book and formulaic, script writer.
Yeah.
And the way they sort of play off each other, I think is really funny. I love, this the interactions about like the script that Donald ends up writing, right? What was it called? The Three.
The three, yeah.
And just like how Charlie absolutely hates it, thinks it's the most formulaic, generic thing ever, that it doesn't make any sense, whatever. And then he turns it in, and like all of Hollywood is like, I love this. This is so creative. This is genius.
Yeah.
We're optioning this for like it was something like obscene about half a million, something insane.
Yeah.
I think there's like a lot there about, inside of Charlie Kaufman there are two wolves. One of them wants to create the most innovative script ever, and the other one just wants to create like the take the easy way out and like create the sort of dumbest, most generic script that everybody will probably just eat up and love. But it's not gonna last.
At one point in the movie, Charlie Kaufman says, "Writing is a journey into the unknown," which I'm sure to plenty of viewers will make them roll their eyes, right? On the other hand, Donald Kaufman is someone who completely relies on the famous Robert McKee's principles on storytelling. So he just goes by the book. He attends writing seminars. So he's that kind of guy. He's that dude. Yeah.
I love. Do we want to talk about the Robert McKee scene? Because that's one of my favorites in the
Yes.
movie.
I think if we're going to talk about the Robert McKee scene, we should venture into the third layer too, because this is like strong third layer now. Yeah. So go
So
ahead.
we'll. I
Yeah.
guess we'll just sort of be hopping all around now. But yeah. So the third layer is like it is sort of a criticism of formulaic Hollywood screenwriting, and that I guess comes in the form of Donald Kaufman's obsession with Robert McKee and his like breakdown of story structure.
Yeah.
And So yeah, and then Charlie ends up going to one of McKee's
Seminars.
seminars. McKee is played by Brian
Brian
Cox, I
Cox,
believe, who
yes.
was actually picked out by Robert McKee himself.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I
Oh,
think he
wow.
ran the script by McKee and was like, "Hey, are you okay with this? Who do you want to play you?" And that was sort of who got picked out. But yeah, there's I love the moment in there where Charlie's sitting in the seminar and is like, you know, you have the voiceover of what's in his head, and he's like, "This is, no, I shouldn't be here. This is useless, whatever." And then you hear Mickey go, "And God help you if you ever use narration to
Yeah.
indicate characters' thoughts. That's lazy storytelling." And then from then on, the film never uses narration. Like, it was using it for the first like hour and a half, and then it just stops as soon as he says that. It's like
Hold
writing
up. I didn't
itself.
even notice that. I know that the voiceover
It
stopped.
comes back right at the end of the movie,
Oh,
but
okay.
until that last scene, the
Yeah.
narration is gone.
That's crazy. 'Cause okay, I know the voiceover stopped like right after Robert McKee said that. But I never realized the voiceover never came back. So that's crazy to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's that great speech about Charlie's like, what happens? What if I'm trying to write a script that's about life where nothing happens and there's no conclusion or anything
No
like that, and
conflict.
no
Yeah, nothing
conflict, and
happens,
McKee
yeah.
gives this great speech about, you know, what do you mean that there's nothing that happens in life? People get shot every day. Somebody makes a conscious decision to murder somebody else. A baby is born every day.
A
You know,
bad
he gives
decision's made, yeah.
all of these things that happen,
Yeah.
which, you know, very like,
Real.
it's real.
It's
I
real,
honestly
yeah.
think like that's a pretty,
Blunt way of putting, of
it's a
describing the
legit, yeah,
world,
yeah.
yeah.
It's a valid conclusion, and yet it still doesn't work for The Orchid Thief, which is really like a book about nothing.
Yeah.
And I, yeah, no, I love the scene where afterwards he, you know, goes with McKee to a bar and starts explaining the book, and is like, "Yeah, so the problem is this book doesn't have an ending. It's left open-ended, and it's about, you know, disappointment and, you know, forever searching for that, you know, thing and longing and all of that." And he explains in that it sort of bookends him explaining why the book works and like why the book is so great. And then from that point forward, they go, "Okay, we have explained to you how the book works and why we can't adapt it into a movie. From this point on, we are going to do whatever the hell we want with these characters."
Yeah.
Which sort of brings us to our third act,
Shit goes off the
which is
fucking
just
rails. Shit goes off the fucking
absolutely
rails.
insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, the fact that they turn Susan Orlean into a drug addict, they make her have an affair with John LaRoche, they have her kill somebody,
Yeah.
right? She's the one
Oh.
that ends up pulling the trigger.
No, so John actually kills or John shoots Don Sean John shoots Donald and then Donald dies in a car crash.
Car crash, right?
Yeah. But then Susan is the one that's like, "Yeah, let's kill them. We need to kill them."
Susan's the murderous
Yeah.
one, right?
Yeah.
Honestly, if I was Susan Orlean, I would definitely hesitate before letting this script be adapted. But it's like so genius because it's sort of like looking at the audience and giving a wink and saying, "Hey, you know that this script wasn't adaptable. We've explained why it's not adaptable. We're gonna give you some bullshit Hollywood ending just because that's how this medium works, and that's the limitations of film as a medium."
Yeah.
And all of this happens like right after Charlie agrees to bring Donald in to finish the script, which I think is so perfect. You know, he brings Donald in, and then of course the ending of the movie has to be formulaic and you know, by the book and pretty much, you know, exactly as McKee would have written a script if that's who was doing it.
Yeah, and yet during the ending, what makes it again, what makes it so genius is, yeah, it is a formulaic ending, but up until this point, we're used to we were used to a movie that was very self-referential, introspective, like a long muse, right? Something very philosophical. And then the ending shows up, and then we don't know what to make of it. And then when the events unfold in the ending, we're just like, well, I didn't even see that coming because I didn't think we were in that movie, you know? We weren't in that. I didn't think we were in that kind of movie. So that's what makes it even better, is that the ending is formulaic, and yet it's unexpected and unpredictable. Because when I was watching the movie, I was like, I had no idea this was going to happen. I had no idea Donald's going to die. I had no idea Susan's going to do all this. And it's incredible to me. Like, well, that, yeah.
And that speech that Donald gives, at, like, sort of right before his death, is so funny because it's very much like, it's like typical, like, Hollywood sort of, like, bullshit.
It's super cheesy.
About, like, you are not...
You are what you love, not what loves you.
You are what you love, not what loves you.
Yeah.
And that's, like, so funny.
Yeah.
But it, like, does track with sort of the major themes of the film, is what's crazy about it.
Yeah, it does.
I think on all levels, really, the movie is about love, it's about passion, and it's about sort of, like, where you invest your time. You know, the Orchid Thief level is about, you know, finding passion in, you know, flowers. Or, you know, John Aloysius has this whole story where he jumped from, like, what was it? Like coins to like fish. Yes, I don't remember. But yes, he, you know, through his life has had many different patterns, just like hyper obsesses, and that's what he fixates on, and that's where he puts his life meaning. Whereas Charlie and Donald both find it in like screenwriting and storytelling. And Charlie Kaufman is like obsessive about writing like the perfect script.
Yeah.
That's his layer of, you know, you are what you love. And then
Susan,
you know, there's the third level of this like fictional character of I forget the love interest's name.
Amelia.
Amelia.
Amelia, yeah.
Played by not Carrie Mulligan, but looks like her.
Yes. But Carrie Mulligan, but British. Unless Carrie Mulligan is British.
Carrie Mulligan is British.
Oh,
actually.
Never mind.
So it does work. Like, but it's like just a stretch enough that it does, you know, fit within the like Hollywood formula of it. And I just think it's so genius that the movie spends, you know, two acts really building this precarious, like pretty much true story.
Yeah.
And really doing double duty in, you know, telling Charlie Kaufman's story and also Susan Orlean's story, like genuinely for the most part.
Yeah.
And then in the third act, Charlie Kaufman and Spike Jonze just decide, basically, we are going to take everything that we've built up to this point and all of the authenticity that we've created and just burn all of that to the ground, just for fun.
Yeah. And that's, well, we're going to head into the fourth layer, which is a little more implicit and a little more ambiguous. But that's what adaptation is trying to show, is that, you know, as limited as filmmaking can seem to be based on, you know, this movie and how it was so difficult to adapt The Orchid Thief into this Hollywood standardized movie, it also shows just how powerful filmmaking can be, because now you have all these tools like in front of you where you can do whatever the fuck you want. You can build something beautiful only to burn it to the ground. You know, that's exactly what Charlie Kaufman does. And in a way, he perverts the book. Oh, he perverts the original subject matter of the book, but he also enhances it too. Because because now, well, first of all, no one was gonna know about the book until adaptation was released. That's a fact. But just overall, I feel like it added so much more meaning to the book itself, because it sort of to me it kind of underscored the ambiguity of the ending of the book, while also enabling us or validating to us and making us feel that it's okay to create our own endings too.
Right. Like, while it adds so much on top of the book and, like, basically has, like, everything is framed around the book, for the most part, the story of the book is still intact.
Yes.
And so I think it is, like, a faithful adaptation in that way, while also totally being, like, its own story that still somehow it manages to find like roots and themes in the subject matter of the book.
Yeah.
And I think that makes it such a great like adaptation.
Yeah.
Pun intended.
Which takes us into the final layer, which to me, the movie is so much more than just like an adaptation or at least it's more than just a movie about adapting a book into a screenplay. it becomes a movie about what it means to, what it really means to live. Because, and the biggest clue that gave that away for me was in the opening, in the first few minutes, we have this kind of a long, like, series of clips showing life and the cycles of life and death. We see the dinosaurs getting wiped out. We see a dead fox decomposing. We see a baby being born. So to me, it suggested, like, this movie is more than just it's more than what it seems. It's about life and what it means to live, what it means to exist. And I think by the end of the movie, I realized that Kaufman's trying to say to live is to find a passion and to do whatever you want and not be hindered by its rules, and to just not let other things interfere with, like, other perspectives, other opinions interfere too much with what you want to create and what you want to do.
I think what's so funny is, you know, it's sort of in the dichotomy of Charlie and Donald.
Yeah.
But it's almost the opposite of the way that they write screenplays, right? Charlie is so obsessed with writing outside of the box, and yet he's so, like, boxed in by his expectations of himself and, you know, society's expectations of him, and he's just, like, afraid to do anything.
Exactly.
Whereas, you know, Donald, who wants to sort of play everything by the book when he's writing a script and, like, you know, when be really formulaic,
yeah,
is not afraid to just do,
yeah,
and, you know, get out there and be himself. And I think, you know, Donald dying within the context of the story is what gives Charlie that, like, kick to just start, like, doing and living. And yeah, I like 100% think that that's really the final layer. Mm-hmm. It's just about, you know, passion and finding love and just living.
Putting yourself out there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I mean, the movie literally ends with, and as Charlie Kaufman implies, the screenplay literally ends with Charlie Kaufman driving away after his lunch with Amelia, after kissing her and telling her how he felt about her. At the end of the day, that's the true message there, is to put yourself out there, to do whatever the fuck you want to do and not give a fuck.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's why this movie, yeah.
To bookend everything.
Yes.
I think the reason why this is the best script ever written is because everything that we've just talked about, this entire multi-layered story, right, is turned in without warning, without any foresight, to studio executives expecting a straightforward adaptation of The Orchid Thief. And the ballsiness and just the amount of risks in that move and just the confidence in knowing that you have something that means so much that it doesn't really matter if they approve it or not, but this is the story that you're going to tell. That, to me, is what makes this the best script ever written. Is just the fact that it was even able to be made is such a miracle. I'm so glad that this movie exists. I'm so glad that we were able to sit here and talk about this movie.
Yeah. I'm probably going to have to agree with you on that. It's at least a contender for the greatest screenplay ever written, just because of all the reasons you just said. The fact that it was made is in and of itself a miracle and an artistic watermark, you know, a watermark in cinematic history. But I also think that, you know, as a story, it works on just so many levels, and we've explained all those levels very in-depth, or, like, pretty in-depth. It's hard to create a script like that, that's so multi-layered, that's so multifaceted. But Charlie Kaufman does it seemingly without any difficulty, you know? It just sort of, it's free-flowing. It feels organic. It feels like something that he was destined to tell. Not like a commercialized, like, Hollywood product, but his own creation. Yeah. Personal to him.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's why, well, I mean, at this point, you probably have already seen adaptation, but this is why you should watch it again. Yeah.
Go rewatch it.
Go rewatch it. Yeah.
It's on Hulu.
Yes. Yes. And other sites. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's our talk on adaptation. Thank you to Eli for recommending this movie and for appearing on the podcast to discuss the brilliance of Charlie Kaufman's script and Spike Jonze's direction in the 2002 film adaptation.
Thanks for having me. I loved getting to talk about this movie any chance I get.
Oh, yeah. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. Thank you for listening, and now you go enjoy adaptation.